Hey, everyone. Saltgrass Steakhouse is now open in Mishawaka. Wrangle up the crew and head down to Saltgrass Mishawaka for an unforgettable experience. Sink your teeth into mouth-watering, char-grilled, certified Angus beef steaks. Sip on ice-cold craft cocktails. And don't forget to try the famous Spicy Range Rattlers, all made daily in the Scratch Kitchen. Start making delicious memories at Saltgrass Mishawaka, 5126 North Main Street, across from Lazy Boy Furniture Galleries. Dine with us today.
On your home for Notre Dame football.
Knocked down by Wooden. The game is over. The Irish is upset. Florida State. Notre Dame is number one.
And Notre Dame basketball.
Number one ranked UCLA Bruins have been upset by the Irish of Notre Dame.
Good! Arike Ogunbowale wins the national championship for Notre Dame.
Plus, Fighting Irish hockey.
They score! Jake Evans scores! Notre Dame, 3.7 seconds away from a spot in the national championship game.
The NFL and Major League Baseball.
Oh my gracious, how about that?
Sports Radio 960 WSBT, WSBTRadio.com, the free WSBT radio app.
Big time onions!
Now, here's your host, seven-time Associated Press Broadcasting Award winner, Darren Pritchett.
Welcome to Budweiser's Weekday Sports Speed on your home of the Fighting Irish and Saturday's Blue Goal Game. Sports Radio 960 WSBT. It is 8 minutes after 5 o'clock on this Monday, April the 15th, your tax day for 2024. I hope you had a terrific weekend. What a beautiful weekend it was. Pretty good weather throughout this week. Little rain mixed in, but a lot of sunshine and some warm weather. And if you like to tee the golf ball up, this is going to be a pretty decent week to accomplish that. After spending how many hours lounging on the couch over the last 4 days, watching coverage of the Masters, and Scottie Scheffler got it done, the favorite going in. Took home his second major championship, both victories at Augusta National. He's won the Masters 2 of the last 3 years. We will have a recap of my 5 storylines for the Masters coming up in just a moment. Plus, our old friend, the former general manager at Warren Golf Club at Notre Dame, John Foster, is going to rejoin us on the program at around 6:10, 1 hour from right now, to offer his thoughts on the Masters. And of course, John, one of the lucky ones who have played Augusta National on a couple of occasions. I love his perspective on the second round. And even the first round, the winds just were absolutely brutal. And we watched the world's best struggle on one of the most gorgeous golf courses in the world. So we'll get John's perspective on the first major of the golf season coming up at 6:10 here on WSBT Radio. Otherwise, Notre Dame football front and center. It is Blue Goal Game Week. Closed scrimmage on Saturday. Marcus Freeman met the media after that scrimmage on Saturday, so we'll have some of his comments coming up here in just a few moments on WSBT Radio. And we'll have our staples, the Twitter question of the day, and our sports wagering segment. We go into Sizzler, all coming up over the next 2 hours on Sports Radio 960 WSBT. We, of course, are streaming live at WSBTRadio.com, our WSBT Radio app, and a live video feed is coming your way on the Twitch app. 10 minutes after the hour, and we begin our opening topics with a conversation on the Notre Dame offense with the help of the commentary of the third-year head coach of the Fighting Irish, Marcus Freeman. A couple of injury notes. Wide receiver Jaden Thomas out of practice with a hamstring injury. Thomas only played 7 games last year due to injury, had 21 catches for 310 yards and 2 touchdowns. 2022, Thomas played in 11 contests, 25 catches for 361 and 3 scores. Thomas has not been ruled out of the Blue Gold game. We'll see if he gets in. Wide receiver Jaden Harrison, known for being a terrific special teams player, kickoff return man from Marshall. He is out for the rest of the spring with a sprain to his plantar fasciitis. So the wide receiving core, even without Bo Collins right now, the transfer from Clemson, he'll be able to start practicing with the team, of course, in the fall. He's a watcher at this particular moment. Wide receiving core not at full capacity at this particular time, sort of like the tight end position without Mitchell Evans and Kevin Bauman. So when we watch the Blue Gold game, we will not see the full cast at wide receiver and tight end. Still a good group, but not at full strength. Of course, the Irish have watched Riley Leonard got to go through the motions, the mental reps during practice after undergoing that second ankle surgery. And the hope is Leonard's going to be at 100% very, very soon. It sounds like he's going through a lot of drills in practice. But during that closed scrimmage on Saturday, he was standing by the head coach and going through the motions. Had a headset on, he was getting the plays, and was kind of going through the routine of each play. Even though he could not fully participate, he was mentally going through every single play, and they ran between 80 and 90 plays at the stadium on Saturday. So here was Marcus Freeman after Saturday's scrimmage, describing to us how helpful it was for Leonard to at least go through all those reps standing behind the offense and standing next to the head coach during the scrimmage on Saturday.
Nice. Yeah, that's just a reflection of who he is. This was his idea, and he wanted to get – he was going to challenge himself to have 100% focus on every rep. So he had the headset on. He knew every call that was going in, and he went and stepped through every single one. And so that's who he's been. He's actually practicing a little bit more now, doing some 7-on-7, some other things. And so, but today we didn't want to let him go. And so for him to get work like that, it just is a reflection of who he is. That's going to make him better. And that was my challenge as a head coach to him, is that, hey, what can you do? Although you're physically not practicing on Saturday, what can you do to get better? And he showed today a chance to do that.
Hey, Riley wants to be out there, and I say this facetiously, but if you're ever going to take off a practice, maybe Saturday was the one, because the defense, the first and second units, looked exceptional. They looked elite. Now, they faced the offense all spring. They probably know a few of the plays, and that helps, but that's not going to take away from the couple of pick sixes, 3 interceptions, reportedly 8 sacks took place. Depending on how you gauge what a sack is with red jerseys on the quarterbacks, defense is ahead of the offense, and I don't think anybody is surprised by that. Third year of Al Golden, first year of Mike Denbrock, putting in a new look Notre Dame offense. So not a big surprise, but the defense was on top of it on Saturday. But it also gave Angeli and Minchie and Carr more opportunities. And C.J. Carr, if you read Notre Dame websites, InsideIndySports.com, Blue and Gold Illustrated, whichever you enjoy, everybody said the same thing. C.J. Carr was one of the stars of the scrimmage. We'll talk more about C.J. Carr's performance with Tyler Horka from Blue and Gold Illustrated coming up at the bottom of this hour. The running back room. I know we've spent a lot of time talking about this room during the offseason, but why not? You lose a dynamic running back in Audric Estime, and of course you lose a great player. Let's don't underestimate how good he was, but it sure does feel like the Irish are in really good shape to have a dynamic running game again this year. You got Jeremiah Love, Jadarian Price, Jabron Payne, and the two young pups, the freshmen, Aeneas Williams and Kedron Young. And Young is kind of that estime guy, 6 foot, 230 pounds. Another tough guy to bring down to the turf. So the way too early Notre Dame running back depth chart, we knew we weren't going to get any look at that. But some interesting thoughts from Coach Freeman when he was asked about the state of that very talented Irish running back room.
Yeah, you know, just I don't know what the clear rotation is going to be as we go into College Station, but we don't need it, an answer to that right now. We got some talented dudes in that room, and we got to find ways to get them the ball. And but in order to prove to us that you're going to get the ball, you got to continuously be trusted to do your job. And so I love what I've seen as in terms of protection, as you brought up, in terms of executing. But it's a long way to get into College Station. We'll get to that point, and we'll talk about reps and how we get them the ball. But for sure, we have discussions of how do we get all these playmakers on offensive ball. We got to find different ways to do that.
All right, so some generic comments from Coach Freeman on his running back room. But I think you, the fan, we in the media, kind of see the same thing, that that combination of Love and Price is going to be exceptional. I'm curious to see who the third down running back is going to be. Dela McCullough has some choices. Who's going to be that guy that they can trust on third down to pick up that blitzer coming after the quarterback, who has the ability to come out of the backfield and catch a pass? Well, kind of everybody has the ability to do that. But it's a very important decision. Who's going to be in short yardage? There are some situational jobs to be won, but overall, this is an incredibly exciting running back room, once again put together by Dela McCullough. You cannot speak highly enough of the job McCullough has done building two back-to-back outstanding running back rooms at the University of Notre Dame. Remember when the Irish were chasing Will Shipley and they threw everything but the kitchen sink at him, trying to get him to South Bend? He picked Clemson. They had no backup plans, but you know what? They were able to work it out, and a guy like Audric Estime and Logan Diggs came to South Bend to reignite the running back room, and now it's as strong as any part of the depth chart for this Notre Dame football team. On the defensive side of the football, no Tyson Ford, the backup defensive tackle, not practicing right now. Coach Freeman says he's taking some time to decide his football future. Marcus Freeman offers some pretty good insight, and again, this is not a big surprise, but the defense is farther along than this new-look Fighting Irish offense, and of course, Al Golden, year three, you would expect the defense to be looking, you know what, pretty sharp at this time with the parts he's got coming back and the defense in place.
Year three, right? It's the same thing I said to you guys last year. After year two, it's, you know, when you go into year three now with pretty much between Golden, Mickens, Al Washington being consistent in terms of the voices in those rooms, year three of the same scheme. Like it's an NFL pro-style defense. There's a lot of defense. And year one, we couldn't perform at the pace, at the level that he wanted, right? And that's always the challenge. How do you get these athletes to play fastest? Like, that's the challenge of a coach. It's not to be so complicated that you're trying to confuse the opponents. Like, okay, how can I get these people to understand what I want and play fastest? Well, it's year three of the pretty much, now we have enhances, but pretty much of the same scheme with a lot of the veterans coming back. Whereas offense, it's practice 11 of a new scheme, right? And so they're going to be ahead, right, defensively, because a lot of returning players year three than the offense, but the offense has done some really good things. And what you'll see from the offense side is that they're going to get every look imaginable, right? They're not playing against a Marcus Freeman defense that you're going to see a couple of different things. You know, you're going to see everything with Al Golden, and it's going to help them improve. Like, if they can understand it, which I know they do, the coaches do, like, this is really good for you. What you're seeing defensively This is really good for you. You're going against one of the best in the country, right? This is going to be one of the best defenses in the country. And that's what our offense is going against every day. But at the end of the day, that's going to make you better.
I would have to imagine the offensive line being retooled at this time. They could probably live with a defense that was, let's say in college class terms, defense 101 or defense 201. With Golden in his third year and the parts coming back, I'm sure the offense feels like they're facing a defense 501 at this particular time. I mean, you think about Jagasaw at left tackle, Coogan at left guard, Craig at center, Shrout at right guard, Baker at right tackle, as they continue to build chemistry and continue to be the leading candidates to start, even though I don't want to eliminate Rocco Spindler. He'll have a say in the battle to be the right guard on this football team. But to face this group, it's got to be a challenge and a great learning process each day in practice. I mean, you got Mills and Cross. They're not in every practice. There's one day a week where their class schedule interferes with practice. Otherwise, facing those mammoth men daily in practice, the interior of the offensive line gets challenged each and every day. And you know what? This next guy isn't the guy we say his name because it's fun to say, but he is producing throughout spring for this Fighting Irish football team. And that is Boubacar Traore. He is 6'4", 240 pounds, going into his sophomore campaign. One of those guys vying for the backup Viper end spot. You've got the grad student Jordan Patello leading the charge, 4 sacks last year. Then you've got Traore and junior Tuihalamaka, a 6'2 junior. They're both competing for that number 2 spot. Fighting Irish head coach Marcus Freeman on Boubacar Traore.
And then Boubacar just, I keep telling us that, he just keeps showing up. He keeps showing up. And that isn't against just the threes, the two. He's showing up against the ones. And so that's what you want to see, right? And that depth, that competition, and those guys that can step up and make plays.
I still think he sounds like a character from The Lion King. Boubacar Traore, Hakuna Matata. Well, he's going to probably play a big role on this Fighting Irish football team. He is trying to put himself in position for major snaps at the Viper end spot and push Jordan Patello along the way. And Tuihalamaka's got to be right now scratching and clawing, trying to keep that number 2 spot. So the Fighting Irish will have their 15th and final practice on Saturday in front of all of you. The Notre Dame football fan at Notre Dame Stadium, the Blue Gold game. Again, we have it for you live on WSBT Radio. Eric Hansen and I will have the play-by-play. 12:30 pregame, 1:05, the game will get underway. Thursday will be the spring game draft, so we'll know which side the quarterbacks are on. I think that's one of the more interesting components of the Blue Gold game. I'm going to guess that maybe Minchie and Carr are on the same side. And then you have Angeli and one of the walk-ons as possibly the other quarterback duel. That would be nice, but I guess they're going to draft, so someone could mess up that combination. All right, 5:24 at WSBT. Sports Beat continues with our final opening topic for tonight. The Masters goes to Scottie Scheffler. On Wednesday, on the eve of the start of the Masters, I offered my top 5 storylines for the first major of the golf season. My 5th storyline was U.S. Open champion American Wyndham Clark. Would he be a contender on his first trip to Augusta National? There has not been a rookie winner of the Masters since Fuzzy Zeller in 1979. Clark was off to a fast start at 3 under par on his front 9 Thursday, but faltered, ended up with a 1 over par 73. And then the tough conditions on Friday, he blew up to a 6 over par 78, finished at +7, and missed the cut by one shot. He made reference to first-round leader Bryson DeChambeau, being a LIV golfer, and they only play 54 holes in LIV golf compared to 72 on the PGA Tour. He wondered if Mr. DeChambeau would be able to handle 72 holes, and then after missing the cut, Brooks Koepka responded by saying, I guess Wyndham's only playing 36 holes this week, and that was the case. So the Ryder Cupper, Wyndham Clark, rookie venture to Augusta National. You got things to learn around that track, and he missed the cut in his first attempt. My number four storyline for the Masters on Wednesday, could Rory McIlroy finish the career Grand Slam? This was his 16th attempt, but he came up short once again. Rory made the cut despite going 71-77. Came back with a 1-under par 71 on Saturday, 1-over par 73 yesterday, and finished plus 4, 15 shots off the pace of winner Scottie Scheffler. Rory has not won a major in 10 years. Valhalla was the last place he won a major, and that is where the PGA Championship will be coming up very, very soon. Next up, in my Masters storylines from Wednesday's show, will Tiger make the cut? Well, he made the cut, but the 23 holes he had to play on Friday really took a lot out of him. 73-72, very respectable. Tiger made the cut, 24th consecutive cut made at Augusta National. That is an all-time record. But then the wheels fell off on Saturday. Tiger shot the worst score in his major championship career, a 10-over par 82. You could see the body was failing, and came back yesterday for the fourth round, a 5-over par 77, and Tiger finished in last place in 60th position at plus 16. But it is the first time in over a year Tiger has played a complete 72-hole golf tournament. So for the guy, it was win or it means nothing. Just getting around 72 holes with all of the body issues is actually a plus and a step in the right direction for the 48-year-old. So we will not see him again until the PGA Championship in May. We'll see him at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst in June, and then the Open Championship, I think at Royal Troon, in July. So we'll see Tiger three more times this summer. My number two storyline from Wednesday's show in regard to the Masters, how well would the 13 LIV golfers fare? Six made the cut. Defending champion John Rahm did not have anything close to his A game, tied for 45th place. He tied with Brooks Koepka, the reigning PGA champion. Phil Mickelson has won the Masters three times. He tied for 43rd. Performing better, former Masters champion Patrick Reed tied for 12th. Tyrrell Hatton at tie for 9th, and Bryson DeChambeau was hanging around the top of the leaderboard on the weekend, finished in a tie for 6th position. So, 7 LIV golfers missed the cut, 6 played the weekend. And finally, on Wednesday's show, Scottie Scheffler, I proclaimed the favorite and my pick to win the championship, and he didn't disappoint, and I don't think he had his best stuff. But while everybody was failing on the back nine Sunday and going backwards, he was steady, put the pedal to the metal with birdies, and pulled away a final round 68, 4-under par, to end the golf tournament at minus 11, won by 4 shots. And Scheffler, the University of Texas product, now has 2 green jackets in the last 3 years. It's a little too early to proclaim this the Scheffler era, because he's only won 2 majors so far. He has been a dominant force on the PGA Tour, well-deserving of the number one ranking from tee to green. He is the best in the world right now. He probably gets too much grief, and there's probably just a little too much critical conversations about his putting. There are times he struggles. We all have our struggles with various parts of our game. He is just doing on the biggest stage imaginable. If you think about it, a lot of the great players, we don't see every one of their shots. You see all of Scottie's shots. So when he misses a couple of putts, it probably gets highlighted a little more than other individuals. He's won the Players. He's won the Masters. Now, the Players is kind of that so-called fifth major. But I think we have to at least acknowledge, for the first time since Tiger, we've got someone that could flirt with the Grand Slam, winning all four majors in the same year. And with the Players in his back pocket, again, that so-called fifth major, could we have a Scotty Slam? Now, way too early for that, but it's worth mentioning because I think compared to some other Masters winners, this guy has the ability to run the table. And let's be honest, there's a couple of guys that play the LIV Golf Tour that don't play those 72 holes. Some would argue that's a factor. I'm not sure I buy in, but let's just throw that into the hopper as well. He's got an awfully good chance to be highly competitive in all of these major championships. And if he wins the PGA, then you start thinking about the Scotty Slam with the first three of five in his possession. If anybody can do it, it feels like over the last 10 years, Scotty has a really, really outstanding chance. So those were my five storylines from Wednesday and previewing the Masters. More Masters conversation with former Warren Golf Club General Manager John Foster coming up in the 6 o'clock hour. It's 5:32. That closed scrimmage on Saturday. What were the takeaways of Blue and Gold Illustrated's Tyler Horka? We will have that conversation coming up next. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat brought to you by Ghost Energy. It's the feel-good energy drink we've all been waiting for, featuring Sour Patch Kids-inspired flavors. By First State Bank, committed to being a premier financial partner. First State Bank demonstrates and delivers hometown values. By Barnaby's of Mishawaka and Granger, now with three locations, serving Michiana's most favorite pizza since 1978. And Bethel University Athletics, sign-ups for youth summer sports camps are underway. Please visit bupilots.com for details. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat continues on your home for Saturday's Blue Goal Game, Sports Radio 960 WSBT. I'm Darren Pritchett. With me is Tyler Horka, the Notre Dame football beat reporter at Blue and Gold Illustrated. You can read Tyler's work at blueandgold.com. He joins us on this Monday to talk Notre Dame football, specifically about the scrimmage that took place at Notre Dame Stadium last Monday. So we'll get some thoughts from Tyler on what he saw from the Fighting Irish right ahead of the Blue Gold game this Saturday. Well, Tyler, it's good to be with you once again. Thank you very much for your time. And I want to start with the eight reported sacks that took place in the scrimmage that had between 80 to 90 plays within it. Now, I know the Irish are really working their offensive line, trying to find the best combinations. How do you assess the sacks? Part of that having to do with lack of chemistry on the offensive line at this stage, but also factoring in that there appears to be some pretty good explosiveness from the defensive line, in particular some young guys.
Yeah, it's a lot of different things, but I'll start with this. I saw a first-team offensive line that is way ahead of the second-team offensive line, and that's good and bad because obviously that means there's some pretty good guys at the top. Like, I think Charles Jagasaw is going to be pretty good. Ashton Craig looks really good. There's, you know, really three or four guards that you have a lot of trust in, and we saw two of them playing on the first-team offensive line. But Kenny Minchie was running for his life a little bit playing with the second team, and that was good and bad for him as well because it allowed him to make a lot of plays with his legs. I was actually very, very impressed with his athleticism, his ability to improvise, get out, and pick up yards on the ground. But it also meant that there were some free runners coming at him, and there were some instances where both sides of the offensive line just didn't pick anybody up running across the edge. And that leads us to what you just said with the athleticism of some of these guys. Man, Boubacar Traore, I thought, looked tremendous. Sophomore, obviously he was a little buried in the depth chart, hardly played last year, but when he did play, he got a sack of Caleb Williams. USC. I get USC wasn't great last year, but that's still Caleb Williams. You're probably going to hear that guy's name called number one overall in the NFL draft next week. So that is no small feat to sack a guy like that. And he looked like on Saturday, Traore, a guy that could sack anybody. You know, you line him up on the edge enough times, he's going to come around, he's going to win enough battles. And like I said, especially if you're not blocking him, then he's definitely going to get to the quarterback. So, yes, the explosive plays along the defensive line, those were there. And I thought the stunts that Al Golden was running, I mean, this didn't look like a Saturday scrimmage in April, Darren. This looked like Al Golden was coming after USC or going after Texas A&M, Florida State, whoever it may be. I was very impressed by the way that he lined Traore up out there, Jalen Snead, even linebackers, you know, like Snead or like Kingston Villamuasa. He knows that he has some guys who are raw, inexperienced, haven't played a lot of football, but at their truest, you know, the truest part of themselves, at their core, they can rush the passer, they can get to the football, and I think Al Golden dialed it up for them. So, good day for the defense, absolutely. The offensive line, again, there was a little bit of a drop-off there from the ones to the twos and the threes.
I want to talk more about the defense in a moment, but let me go back to the offensive line. Do you think you saw the starting offensive line together during that scrimmage? If so, what did you see?
Yeah, I think I did. And the only thing that makes me say maybe we did not was Rocco Spindler was running with the twos. And obviously, for the better part of last season, until he injured his knee way, way late, and I think it was November when he finally went down, only missed three games. He was the, you know, 10-game starter for this football team. Billy Shrouth moved into that role last year, and he really hasn't given it up as Spindler has been trying to get to 100%, which I think he's nearing, but still might not be there. So that's the one spot, like I said earlier, you've probably got three guards that you feel really comfortable in playing, Pat Coogan being the other one. He is going to started all 13 games last year, lined up at first-team left guard as usual in the scrimmage. So, and I mentioned Jagasaw. So you're looking at Jagasaw and Coogan on the left side. I mentioned Ashton Craig. He is by far your best center because, Darren, let me tell you, Sam Pendleton playing second-team center, he had a lot of errant snaps, high, low, couldn't really find the quarterback in a shotgun situation, so that was a little alarming. Good thing you have Ashton Craig because I think he's for sure your starter. And then, you know, it's that right side, I guess, we're looking at, Darren, where Spindler can maybe come back and compete with Shrouth and take his job back. That's going to be a little bit of a battle. And then Tosh Baker is really starting out of necessity right now at right tackle. He's been at Notre Dame for 5 years, has never been able to full-time starter. Having Joe Alt and Blake Fisher obviously dictates a little bit of that, but I think Notre Dame is going to be thinking all the time in the next 4 months, do we have everything we need at right tackle? Is Emil Wagner maybe better than Baker? Can we somehow steal somebody out of the portal this late in the game? I'm looking at that right side of the line, Darren, as areas where we may see a shakeup between now and August 31st.
Tyler Horka talking Notre Dame football, specifically the closed scrimmage Saturday at Notre Dame Stadium. Now to the defensive side, you've talked about the pressure that was put on that offensive line, including some young guys. Traore really stood out. They sounded, or I should say, this defense looked very elite in this scrimmage. And Tyler, it's pretty scary knowing that arguably your best defensive player, cornerback Benjamin Morrison's on the sideline right now.
Yeah, they just got pieces everywhere, man. I mean, all three levels, the line, the linebackers, the secondary, there's just really good players out there. We saw Jaden Mickey with the pick six. Xavier Watts, remember him? Led the NCAA in interceptions last year with 7. He got another one. Got his hands on the football again on Saturday. Took that to the house for an interception. We've been pumping up Adon Schuler for this entire spring. I thought he's had a phenomenal spring. Just a sophomore. Didn't play a whole lot of football last year because Notre Dame had a couple veteran safeties in Watts and DJ Brown. He gets his hands on the ball, ends the scrimmage with an interception of Steve Angeli. So the secondary, especially when you do get Morrison back, I mean, those guys are set. You got three really good corners in Morrison, Mickey, and Gray. The latter two probably going to be rotating out. You hope Morrison's healthy all year because he's just going to eat up so many snaps, as is Xavier Watts. I think Schuler is coming into his own there. Jordan Clark, I thought looked really good at nickel. He was covering up guys. Jaden Greathouse got the best of him a couple times, but Clark battled back and, you know, had a couple PBUs and looked pretty solid in coverage. So the secondary set. The linebackers, they're young, but they're just so much upside. I mentioned a couple of them earlier. That's without even mentioning Drake Bowen yet. I think he had he's just a really solid football player, does all the right things, smart player, really learned behind J.D. Bertrand, did his best to soak all that up. He told us that a couple weeks ago when we talked to him. He's trying to emulate J.D. Bertrand, but he's trying to be Drake Bowen at the same time. And I think that's going to be a perfect combination for him. So, yeah, just across the board, there's so many guys. And I'll end with this. Riley Mills and Howard Cross, they still look very, very stout in the middle of that Notre Dame defensive line. And that's kind of where everything starts up front. So just a really good group, Darren.
Two-part question. Number one, do you agree with the majority that C.J. Carr had the best day of all the quarterbacks? Second part of the question is, did C.J. ever work with the number one offense, and did he ever face the number one defense?
The second part of that question, I believe, is no.
Okay.
I don't think he ever worked with the ones, and I do not believe he ever went against the first-team defense. After about the second or series or so, there was a lot of mixing and matching, but you could still tell when they were trotting out the best of the best with maybe just a mixture of twos here and there. And I don't think Carr ever faced that, but that being said, he was thrown to some walk-on receivers at times, and he made Jack Polian look good. And if you can make Jack Polian look good, then you're probably doing something special. And this kind of goes to the root of your question, Darren. I turned to my colleagues at one point. We watched this from the press box, and this was probably, I mean, we're talking 80% through this thing, maybe 90% of the way through this scrimmage. And I said, it's gotten to the point where C.J. Carr deserves a shot out there with the ones because he's playing so well, and I think we all want to see that. And I think I actually used this exact terminology and phrasing. I told them, Mike Denbrock's a really smart offensive coordinator. I get it. They kind of stuck to the script of ones, twos, and threes, and Jelly, Minchie, Carr. But if he keeps doing that, and say he does that again on Saturday in the blue-gold game, and then leading into fall camp or whatever, he's going to earn some reps. At least, you know, give the kid a series with the ones and see what he can do with those guys. Because, like I said, I was watching this unfold, and you mentioned seven or eight different beat writers and sources that have said that he looked really good. I'm definitely one of those. I was sitting up there saying, oh, man, just give me one series of C.J. Carr with the ones, because I think we deserve to see that, and I think he deserved the looks, to be quite honest.
Now, Marcus Freeman said this isn't a one-day deal. This has been consistently happening throughout spring practice, C.J. Carr playing at a very high level. We're very early in this process. I don't want to jump the gun, but what do you think this means, big picture, heading into the fall?
Yeah, I've actually talked to some people that I won't disclose their names here, but, you know, just kind of talking about the state of this football program, where it's come from, where it's going. And it always goes back to the quarterback position. And it's always like, yeah, Jack Cohn was a great guy, but he was a one-year rental. And, you know, he kind of hit a ceiling at Notre Dame. And Ian Book always had a ceiling because, you know, he was what he was, right? Darren, just a gamer who could scramble around a little bit. And he was never viewed as one of those guys in college football. I think people around this program are viewing C.J. Carr as a potential that guy, you know, someone who's mentioned with the best quarterbacks out there in college football, you know, the ones that go to Alabama and Ohio State and even Michigan now. I think a lot of people think that Notre Dame has that guy in C.J. Carr. And that gets back to the quote that you just said with Marcus Freeman. It's been happening ever since he stepped on campus. And he stepped on campus as soon as he literally possibly could. I mean, this kid was taking Sun Bowl reps when all of his friends in high school were, you know, getting 2 weeks off of high school for Christmas vacation. This kid went down to Notre Dame and started practicing with the big boys and was a part of that. So it started as early as it could, and I think it's going to last a while too, because I kind of tend to agree with the people that I've been talking to. He's you know, he's probably the next guy at Notre Dame. Does that mean he's going to start in 2024 at any time? Some things are going to have to break his way, and that would mean breaking the way or not breaking in Notre Dame's favor, so to speak, because that would probably mean a sustained injury to Riley Leonard and Steve Angeli looking bad, which nobody wants, or, you know, Kenny Minchie transferring. You know, some things are going to happen for C.J. Carr to start football games in 2024, but I would not be shocked in 2025 if we're talking about C.J. Carr starting quarterback in Notre Dame.
Not all the wide receivers and tight ends are healthy or can participate in spring practice at this particular time. But based on the players that were available on Saturday, were those units good enough? Good enough for this offense to take step forwards this year and ultimately be a playoff team?
Mixed bag, I would say. The one thing that really stood out to me was Jaden Greathouse can be a number one at a lot of places. And I think it's becoming more and more clear just how banged up he was last year. Because I can't get over Darren, and I know it was Navy, but it's Ireland. It's nationally televised. Everyone's watching. It's the first college game of his career. And he looked really good on those two touchdowns that he scored in Ireland. And he looked really good on that touchdown that he scored in Pitt. And that was the back half of the year. He was finally coming back around a little bit. What I saw on Saturday was a Jaden Greathouse that looked like the best version of himself and probably even better. I mean, he's a sophomore. He's going to keep getting better for a while. I believe he was the only player to catch consecutive passes on two different instances in that scrimmage. So Steve Angeli looked his way two times in a row, and it worked two times in a row. I think he gained probably 40 to 50 yards on those two catches. And then it happened later in the scrimmage as well. Might have even been a different quarterback throwing him the ball at that point too. So he's a guy, and I think he can be really good. Jordan Faison is obviously a guy too. So they're going to be working in tandem and competing for reps. Mike Denbrock's got a good problem on his hands there. I thought Cam Williams looked better. He's a freshman. I think that Cam Williams and or Micah Gilbert can have the type of season that Errico Flores had last year where, you know, he wasn't dominant, but he was consistent. He stayed healthy. And say what you want about Errico Flores leaving, but the stats that he put up at the end of the year, if you had either Gilbert or Williams do that, you know, 25 catches, over 400 yards, a score. Everyone remembers the two-point conversion. Like, I think those guys could be that type of player. Probably a little more upside with Williams even. I thought he had a really good scrimmage. So, yeah, there's talent in this room. Health, not all the time, obviously, because Jaden Thomas was held out of this thing. His hamstring is still bugging him. Jaden Harrison, the transfer from Marshall, his foot is kind of flared up on him, and he's been in a walking boot for a bit. So it's another one of those positions where Notre Dame has combated health issues, but you know, the guys that I mentioned, those two freshmen, Jaden Greathouse, and then I'll throw Chris Mitchell in there as well. He made a couple really nice catches in this thing. I think that he runs a really good route, has some shake and some wiggle to his game. If he stays healthy, then he's a guy that defenses have to account for all the time. So, yeah, to your point, pieces all over the place. They just got to stay healthy, and Denbrock's got to put them together.
I guess the best way to wrap up the football portion of our conversation, since you've talked about a lot of areas, is go with this. There were the interceptions that took place during the scrimmage. A couple went back to the house for pick sixes. The defense is looking elite. But as you look at the interceptions, was that the defense dominating the particular play? Was it a quarterback making a bad decision? Is there any connect the dots between the three interceptions that has you concerned at all? Or is this just the defense being better?
I think it was a little bit, the terminology there, connecting the dots, because I honestly think it was a little bit of the defense having gone against this offense since March 7th, knowing what was coming.
Okay.
I saw routes jumped on both the Mickey and Watts interceptions, and those two play well. The Minchie one for sure. Who Minchie threw his interception to Watts. Watts knew exactly what was coming, jumped right in front of it, had no chance. I was a little bit more worried with the Steve Angeli interceptions because he had other opportunities or maybe an opportunity not to throw the ball. And he still threw the ball in places that obviously ended in interceptions. So it was a knock on Steve Angeli we've always talked about him as a good decision maker, smart player, knows his limits, is not going to test them too much. He tested them on Saturday, and you know, he got bit a little bit.
Finally, since you were last on the program, the women's basketball team lost a second player to the transfer portal, this time center Nat Marshall. And, boy, she was huge for this team with all the injuries coming down the stretch. She played the most important minutes of her career in the postseason. What is the significance of her loss?
Yeah, this is the KK Bransford version as it relates to the Notre Dame post play. They're both kind of the same players, serve the same purposes in different positions on the basketball court. So there's a lot of things that go with this. I thought Marshall was going to continue to be a very good role player, bring in that defensive intensity, can even get you a couple buckets at times. She showed she can make the mid-range jumper and has a little bit of a post-game tour. So you're losing that off the bench. And when you're losing something off the bench, obviously you're obviously losing another number. You're losing depth. And the number is now down to 9 scholarship players for the 2024-2025 season. That is simply not enough players to comfortably get through a season, because I hate to say it, but we've seen that it's kind of impossible to get through an entire season without at least one injury. Last year was like 4 or 5 injuries for this team. So Nielle Ivey's going to have to hit the portal pretty hard. And I think she's going to try to replace Bransford with someone who's willing to come off the bench and play that energizer type of role. And obviously she needs some depth in the post now too, because I think everybody is pointing toward the 5-star freshman Kate Koval to start, but who knows when Kylie Watson is healthy and available to be a supplemental player for her. And now you don't have Marshall as a supplemental player. So it's obviously there are other players you could have lost that would have hurt more. Hannah Hidalgo's name was rumored, and she kind of put those rumors to rest and said, I'm staying at Notre Dame. That's huge. But when you're losing anybody in this era where Notre Dame's been battling scholarship numbers for, it seems like, 3 seasons in a row, it kind of stings a little bit.
Saturday is one of the biggest days of the Notre Dame football offseason with the Blue Gold game. For subscribers to Blue and Gold Illustrated, or people maybe considering it, what are they going to find on your website Saturday and throughout the weekend?
A lot of stuff. We're going to break this down from all different angles. We have 3 people in the press box and then a photographer on the field as well. So we're sending the full arsenal that Blue and Gold has to offer to this game. And we'll even have people remotely working on this thing to cover it as well, because you can watch it on Peacock. I know a lot of fans out there are a little bummed by that, but they should be over it by now. A lot of these Notre Dame things are on Peacock, but maybe for those who don't, go to blueandgold.com, because we will be there. We'll provide a ton of coverage, just offensive breakdowns, defensive breakdowns, looking at the quarterbacks in particular, some sidebar stories. Just like you said, this is one of the biggest days in the Notre Dame football offseason, and Blue and Gold definitely strives to cover it as well as anybody out there.
Tyler, greatly appreciate your time. Now go make some birdies.
All right, yeah, it's a beautiful day in South Bend, so I'm going to take advantage of that for 9 holes here.
Do your best, Scotty Scheffler. Very good. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, I went to the University of Texas like Scotty, but
I'm not
sure if I can play like Scotty. I'll do my best.
All right, that was Tyler Hork. We had to pre-record our interview this week. Normally we're live, but he had some things to take care of. And right after we got done with our interview, some Notre Dame women's basketball news came about. And a big, big boost to next season. This isn't a surprise, but Maddie Westbeld is returning for a 5th season. Westbeld this year averaged 14 points and a career-high 8.7 rebounds per game. So Westbeld is coming back to a loaded starting lineup. You would have to imagine it is Hannah Hidalgo, Olivia Miles, Sonia Citron, Maddie Westbeld, and the dynamic freshman forward, Kate Koval. And when the preseason rankings come out in several months, Notre Dame is going to be a top 5 team in the country with a host of expectations thrown on their shoulders. I'm sure they've got high expectations in their locker room, but from the outside, there's no doubt all eyes are going to be on the Notre Dame women's basketball program next year. including Matty Westfeld, coming back. 6 o'clock is our time. Sports Beat continues next on WSBT South. It is 12 minutes after 6 o'clock on your home for Saturday's Blue Goal game at 1 o'clock. Sports Radio 960 WSBT. My name is Darren Pritchett, joined by a great friend, the former general manager at Notre Dame's Warren Golf Club. And that is Mr. John Foster. And he is going to talk a little Masters, since he is one of the few individuals that I know that has played Augusta National on a couple of occasions. Scottie Scheffler, his second green jacket, won yesterday a four-shot victory over the field. And I don't even think Scottie had absolutely his best stuff all week, and he still wins by four shots. So first off, John, always great to hear your voice. How are you today?
I'm great, Darren. I'm so glad to have heard from you yesterday. I'm glad to come on and talk to you. It's been, a year since I've spoken with you, the last Masters, I believe.
Yeah, I think we text back and forth, but
oh yeah,
by golly.
Yeah, you do keep me informed of important news coming from Notre Dame.
Yeah, which,
I remember a few in particular where I had to pull the car over when you actually texted me.
Yeah, I give this to John $5.99 a month, so it's a great service. And if you'd like to join me, we'll give you more details later.
That's great.
I got to ask you, John, right off the bat, you have had the great pleasure of playing Augusta National on a couple of occasions. I'm sure it wasn't 35 to 40 mile per hour winds the days that you played, but can you offer some perspective to, we all know how difficult that golf course is, and now you factor in that type of wind. Just what type of challenge was that for the world's best in the first couple of rounds of the Masters?
I mean, I think it was both entertaining and really frustrating to watch, Darren, because you know that the whole key to playing that golf course for these guys, especially, is the approach shot. And granted, even the tee shots were difficult, but approach shots, there are specific places on the greens that you need to hit in order to be in a position to either make birdie or at least two putt. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't hit them because of the wind. I mean, I'm glad they came up with the technology where you can actually see the ball fly, because I think it gave you a real appreciation of how much the wind was curving the ball. And it was out of their control. It was out of the player's control. They could not do anything about it. So the one thing I will say, every time I watch the Masters and they've done something in the golf course, those holes are somewhat unrecognizable to me based when I played there, which was almost 20 years ago.
Wow.
Like number 10 is literally 90 yards longer than when I played. And I didn't play the back tees. I played the member tees. And number 4, you know, we played it at 170. Oh. And I think the back tee at that point was 190. It was 240 this week. And 6 was the same way. Every hole you look at, like 7, even I could hit a driver on 7 and maybe have a little pitch onto the green or something like that. They've stretched that hole out to where, you know, those guys used to hit 3 woods and 3 irons up around the green. So, you know, granted, technology has accounted for a lot more distance off the tee for these guys and for every club. And I'm not saying that it wasn't warranted. I think it was warranted because that was a really competitive Masters, despite the fact, you know, the scores that were shot on those days where it was windy, primarily Thursday and Friday, were actually just as good as they were though over the weekend, which I find really puzzling. Only 7 guys broke par, which is really unusual. So I think they found the secret sauce down there to keep these guys at bay. And there wasn't anything tricky unless, did you see anything with goofy hole locations or something? I never really saw that.
I didn't, and the one thing I was curious about, and maybe it's just recency bias, but I felt like they wanted those greens fast and firm, and they were as a light of shade of green that I can remember.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're probably as fast as everybody, but I agree with you. I think they were a lot more firm. I didn't see a lot of balls backing up necessarily.
No.
And part of that, though, I think was they were having to hit the ball so low to keep it out of the wind, that they, although you spin it doing that, it just wasn't the same as these high shots that they hit. Like Scheffler normally hits really high approach shots in the green. He's just absolutely amazing. He's the most boring, great player I think I've ever seen. And when I say boring, it's like every shot. You know, it's hard. Everybody says, well, it's hard to compare someone to Tiger Woods. I'm not so sure Tiger was any more dominant than Scheffler was, and as he is right now. You think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's incredible. I had no doubt he's going to win that thing from the first tee shot of the fourth day of the final day yesterday. I had no doubt he's going to win. And it's the same way it was with Tiger. Remember when he had a lead? There was no way he was going to lose.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, he didn't – the guys, once again, had opportunities, just couldn't make any putts. I found it entertaining. I don't know. Did you find it enjoyable?
See, I was actually – texting our good friend from Blackthorn, Tim Firestone, on Saturday, and we had a slight conversation about the scoring when we had that Masters in November, COVID year, and Dustin Johnson won at 20 under, and I think Spieth might have won at 16 under.
Yeah.
You know, this was a tournament. You take away Scotty, 6-7 under par, you know, would have been your winning score, but he won by 4. And we had the conversation, which is more enjoyable, to see all the birdies and stuff like we saw with Dustin and Spieth or Tiger or something like this? And I got to be honest with you, I think you remember when we were together talking golf all the time that I really love the best golfers challenge 4 times a year that par is protected. And I really enjoyed seeing the struggles of these guys. I mean, you saw Homa and you saw Morikawa pushing the envelope on Sunday because they knew Scotty had the lead and they had to go get him. They made fatal mistakes and they faded away. I loved the fact that birdie was protected, par was a good score, and you had to just absolutely grind around that golf course. So I guess I prefer the lower scoring or the higher scoring, I guess.
I think I did too. I mean, you look at the most enigmatic hole in golf is number 12. How you can make 5 on that, as both of those guys did.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand how. I'm sure I can. But I'm looking at that. And the one thing that has changed from a scoring standpoint, the 4 par 5s are no longer guaranteed birdies and possible eagles. You know, the way they've stretched 13 and 15 out, those used to be almost gimme birdies. They aren't anymore.
Yeah.
A lot of guys were making, you know, struggling to make par. So I think from a scoring standpoint, if you look at, there's 16 times you play par fives there. I'd like to see what the par five score was, but scores were. But I bet for Scheffler, he's no more than 2 or 3 under on par fives. That normally, there's 7 or 8 under on par fives alone. So I think that's probably the big difference, Darren. But I found it really enjoyable seeing these guys having to get up and down from crazy positions, and yet they did. I mean, it really showcased how good they are. So.
Former general manager at Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame, John Foster, is my guest. I would have to imagine the 11th hole at Augusta National, the long par 4, the green protected to the left by that lake, and the ball hitting the left side of the green will filter down in the water. That has to be one of the most intimidating shots in all of golf. I know Sawgrass, the 17th Island Green, that's in that conversation, but that approach shot into 11, John, I don't know if you remember playing that hole specifically, but I would have to imagine that is a very easy place to just flail it out to the right and you take your medicine.
No, and I misspoke about when I said number 10 was 80 yards. I meant number 11.
Okay.
I misspoke there because when I played it, I hit driver 6-iron, I think, or driver 7-iron one of the times. You could kind of get it going down that hill. And, the play was out to the right side of green. Where these guys were coming in from and the distance from which they were coming, when you see a guy of Scheffler's ability or Tommy Fleetwood and these guys aiming 40 yards to the right of a green just to make sure they don't go in the water, that's insane. And yet, most of them got up and down. And I don't know what, Homa was thinking and Morikawa was thinking. I mean, you just don't do that. Unless that was a miss hit. I can't believe they're aiming that way. But that, to me, that's a really cool hole. But once again, if you're looking for low scores, you probably hate that hole. Because you're looking at, God, it's hard to make a par, let alone, make a birdie on that. So, it was totally different when I played it, believe me. Yeah.
For people that watch Scotty Scheffler hit a golf ball and to see all the excess movement with his feet, he does everything we're told not to do as someone hitting a golf shot, but the club face is square when he makes contact with the golf ball. Do we overanalyze the footwork of Scheffler? Does most of that happen after the ball is off his club face? How would you describe that to people watching as someone that has taught the golf swing for so many years?
What I see, it's incredible that he can do what he does, and he does it because he's so on balance. Now, you look at that, no, he's not on balance. His feet are moving around. Try moving your feet like that, not falling down when you hit a golf ball. I think balance is the whole key to his. So he generates so much club head speed. And, you know, sliding his right foot and rolling his left foot, his left ankle, is his way of getting through the golf ball and getting his weight to the left side. That's how he does it. You know, that's a drill we used to teach a lot called a step through, when you take, you know, you swing at it and you just step like Gary Player did. I don't remember him. After his shot, he would step with his right foot towards the target. That's all Scheffler's doing. But I think the amazing part is, Darren, not that he can square the club face, generate a lot of speed, kind of sliding that right foot and stuff. It's that he can do it repeatedly because his balance is so good. His flexibility is so good. So I look at it and it looks like some guy playing in front of me on the Tuesday game down here, you know? And it's like, God, what's wrong with that guy's swing?
Oh,
and
my gosh.
My Lord, he hits a long way, too. So God bless him, you know? I mean, what's not to like about him?
Hey, it works for him. John,
exactly.
I'm really concerned because I'm someone that loves to watch golf, even when the majors are not taking place. I like the other events. And yeah. I got to be honest with you, it's getting harder and harder to tune in to even like the Arnold Palmer Invitational, just because the field is getting to the point where there are so many big names not participating, some because they're playing live golf, others just take time off. We've had some leaderboards. It was kind of like, wow, who are these guys? Now, in time, they're going to become more household names. But I know Tiger was asked this week about some negotiations, and he said there was positive movement, didn't act like anything was close. But are we getting to a danger point, John, with the game of golf, with these golfers being split up? We love it when the majors happen. They all come together. But now for the next couple of weeks before the PGA, it's just awfully hard to get overly excited. And, in fact, the PGA Tour stop is near you this week.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Now, this is one of the designated events, you know.
Big difference,
quotations, because all the big names are going to play in it because they basically have to get FedEx points. And the other thing is it's a limited field. You know, and so there's a bunch of things going on, a lot of dynamics. And one is the live dynamic. The other dynamic, Darren, I have trouble watching these non-designated events because it's a bunch of no-names playing. Because, and I say that with respect because a lot of these guys are going to be known names. But there's just, I'm watching this, I turn it on, I follow golf, I'll see three or four consecutive foursomes and not know anybody that's playing. Yet on the other hand, you pull in, you know, you look at these other events and you don't see anybody you don't know. So there's this polarization going on. I know the players are upset about it. And I think I mentioned to you, I work at not my own club, I work at another club here a couple days a week just to kind of keep me busy and keep me involved with golf. And we have 7 golf pros there, okay?
What?
And to a person, I know I'm the oldest guy there, by the way.
One per member.
Yes, well, there's 2 golf courses, yeah. But still, talking to all the other guys, they feel the same way. We don't even have it on in the shop a lot of times, unless it's a major event. And that's just a terrible commentary. But I'm in complete agreement with you, Darren. They got to do something. And it goes beyond live. It goes beyond... You know, the rich get richer with these guys, and there's just not as many avenues for these other players to come up and make it. So I think they've got to reshuffle the deck somehow. And I think Tim Fincham's done a horrible job. And how can you screw up that business model? You know, and he has. So, I think something's got to be done. The Masters is probably the last tournament I'm going to enjoy. I do watch the PGA, not nearly as intently, but until the U.S. Open this year. I don't even watch the others. It's too bad.
Live golf is unwatchable. I've tried a couple of times, and there's just the graphics, the music. There was one event recently. I only saw the Twitter video. John Rahm hitting in to a par 4, his approach shot. There was not one person standing around the green. And I know he made a ton of money, but the competitive nature of someone like John Rahm, this can't be what he was signing up for. In fact, at the Masters, you got the sense, some of his comments, that without saying I screwed up, I think he knows he made a bad choice despite the money.
He's got buyer's remorse. You know he does.
Yes, he does.
I don't know what you do about it. You know, he made a decision. I think ultimately they will find some paths back for people. I don't see a merging per se of, you can't really. I mean, unless the whole idea behind LIV, which stands for 54, is 54 holes. It's 3 days. Yeah. It isn't 72. So, you know, that's Roman numerals for 54. So unless that was the whole concept, shotgun start, you know, they made the point, how can you have an exciting finish when the finish is going to be on the second hole for maybe the guy that's leading, and the next closest guy is going to finish on seventh? It's just silly. And so if they do, quote, merge, I just think they'll merge players. There's no way they're going to adopt any of that format or any of the other goofy stuff they do on Liv. I think it was funny that Greg Norman had to buy his own ticket.
Yeah, he did. And, of course, he walked around McElroy just to just to aggravate him. I tell you what, though, John, there's a lot of guys that went to Liv because their careers were kind of heading down hill, like Ian Poulter and Bubba Watson. So it makes sense. Yeah. And honestly, and I'm sure I'm leaving out a couple of names, but outside of Rahm, Koepka, Cam Smith, the fun of watching Hatton play, you can have the rest. I'd like to have some of those guys back, but a lot of these guys that were kind of past their prime, we really don't need them. And I just feel like you get some of the big, big names back, that's all you really need.
Yeah. Darren, did you see, have you ever seen a golfer more disinterested than Dustin Johnson this week?
Oh, my gosh.
It was just so obvious. He wanted to be anywhere but there. You know, he's cashed a check. He has no incentive. And I don't think he was exactly the most driven player on tour anyway. He's supremely talented, and that got him by. But, yeah, I could care less if I ever watched Dustin Johnson hit a golf ball again. And you're right. There's no more than a handful of the people I would like to see. But if you bring them back onto the regular tour, you're still going to have some issues with the limited fields, the preferred fields, and all these things that Rory fought for. You know, and he's caused a lot of dissent within the ranks. And there just aren't a lot of as many opportunities as there were, you know, for up and coming talented players. So,
I guess
if you're Oberg and can make a Ryder Cup team before you even play in a major, that kid's so good.
And wasn't he on the team that beat Koepka and Scheffler like 9-7?
Smoked him. He played with Parnovic. What's his name? The other Swede who played terribly this week. Oh, my goodness.
I can't think of his name either.
I got an excuse. I'm old. So you have no excuse. Victor Hovland.
Victor Hovland, yes. Yes.
Exactly.
Oh, I love it. Hey, finally, before we let you go, just it was strange, but it was necessary to hear Tiger Woods say that, you know what? It was kind of a successful week because he got through 72 holes for the first time in over a year. For a guy that was all about winning and second place didn't matter. Yeah. I'm glad he has that attitude, but it's really strange to hear him make those type of comments, in particular after 82-77 over the weekend.
I don't, you know, he's definitely lowered the goalposts in terms of what his goals are. And I think, you know, he got the cut record, which he secured that this weekend. I don't see him as, like you saw Vijay Singh playing this week, you know, past champions. I don't see Tiger doing that as long as some of these other players have. I mean, Ben played until he was 64, I think, Crenshaw. And some of these other guys, I can't see Tiger going out there in kind of a ceremonial fashion. I mean, Mike Weir played this week. I think he may have made the cut or something. But I think Tiger pretty well will hang it up if he feels he's not going to be competitive. Although the guy really, I mean, he really hit the ball well. He just didn't make any putts early on. Then I think it kind of wore him down. I mean, he's obviously not in the greatest physical shape. Just watching walks kind of painful.
Mm. Olathabal and Singh made the cut, showing you experience in the wind. Knowing where to hit the ball was a major, major plus.
Well, I saw they had the track man on Olathabal on 5, and he smoked a driver that carried 210 or 220, and whoever he was playing with had a 305 carry. Ugh. Yet he parred the hole, and the other guy parred the hole. I thought it was really interesting, but that's just going to wear you out trying to keep up with that.
Oh, my gosh. That's a two-time Masters champion, what, 93, 94, and 99. Just was a solid player. And it's amazing. Compared to other sports, golfers can vanish in no time at all. It's amazing how it can slip away, and I'm sure the nerve goes at some point after all those high-pressure situations. Yeah. But that was a guy I thought that might win 5-6 majors and just had a good, solid career, but not that, I guess, superstardom that I thought might occur after – you know, we saw Seve come from Spain.
Right. He had the foot injury that one time, which almost cost him his career when he came back. He did win one Masters after that, but that was about it for him. So I think it was more of an injury thing with him, Darren. But, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of those. I mean, I couldn't believe Danny Willett was playing this week, and he played really well.
Yeah.
Like, what's he doing? Does he have another job when the Masters is going on?
I don't know. I'm not quite sure. He had a bad accident or something, needing that shoulder surgery.
He did. That is correct. Yeah, I know that. So I can relate to that.
All right. So final question for you. If you had the chance to play one hole at Augusta National right now, just one hole, which hole would you play?
Well, I think.
Yep.
Because I think I can maybe make better than five, and then I can say that I played better than Homa or Colin Morikawa. I mean, by the way, I didn't make much better than five, but I did play. I was about the spot that Homa was, except higher up on the hill one day. So, yeah.
Well,
but that's probably the one I would play.
Well,
yeah.
John,
but
I will.
It requires less walking on my part. Not much of a walk.
I will tell you, when I play Augusta on PlayStation 5, I take Nicholas's advice and always hit right over the bunker. And if I come up short, I'm in the bunker. If I go long, I'm okay. So I always just hit over the bunker.
Well, you're assuming the ball's going to go where you intended to.
Oh.
That's my biggest issue. Yeah.
I've
got great schematic. I've got great plans, but it just never seems like that.
So. Somebody had a great question. I think it was Golf Digest asked the question this week. You're disqualified since you played at Augusta National. But the question was, which would you rather – play one round at Augusta National or have Masters tickets for life? That's a tough one.
It is, but I don't know. Again, I'm an old guy. I looked at that crowd this weekend. I mean, a number of people that I like to kind of give the needle to said, are you going to go, you want to watch the Masters? I said, no, if I can't play the course, it just means nothing to go over there. Like somebody else played. But I think playing it again would probably be my choice. It's just, there are so many people there. But everybody I know that goes just loves it. So.
I just can't imagine. Even with nobody around that first tee standing there, I'd be shaking in my boots.
Well, I was in the nine fairway on my first drive off of one the very first day, if that tells you anything. I got a little quick.
Did anyone in a green jacket give you kind of that look like, should you be here, sir?
There were no green jackets. No green jackets around.
I didn't know. I didn't know this, but when they put the jacket on the winner, they borrow it from someone in the club that's measurements are close, and then they take care of the actual measurements later. Now, with Scotty, probably different. They have his ready to go. But a first-time winner, they find someone on the membership committee, and they just use that for a moment. So I learned
there you go. I guess they had trouble when Craig Stadler won, I would think.
Patrick Reed.
Good point.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, John, I'm going to let you go here. We've chatted here and really appreciate the conversation as always, and maybe we can catch up later this summer, talk a little more golf if you don't mind.
Anytime you give me a call, buddy, okay?
Sounds good, John. Thank you. Be well and hit them straight.
All right, Darren. See you, buddy.
All right, take care. That's John Foster, the former general manager at Notre Dame's Warren Golf Club. Talked a little Masters, talked a little golf, Live Golf, PGA Tour. We got to get this worked out very, very soon. 636 at WSBT.
Imagine having all the money you need for retirement.
641 at Sports Radio 960 WSBT. I'm Darren Pritchett. We roll on with this installment of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat. Brought to you by Ghost Energy, Barnabys of Mishawaka and Granger, Bethel University Athletics, and First State Bank. The Chicago Cubs in the desert tonight to take on the Arizona Diamondbacks, the defending National League champions. And the Cubs will be without one of their best bats so far this season. The Cubs have announced late this afternoon that starting right fielder Seiya Suzuki will head to the 10-day injured list with an oblique strain. It's going to be more than 10 days, obviously, with that type of injury. Suzuki sustained an oblique strain in the 2023 spring training season, and he was out for 6 weeks. So if you factor in 6 weeks again for this oblique, then that means toward the end of May, Suzuki might be back. But over the first 15 games, Seiya Suzuki has been terrific, hitting .305 with a .368 on base, an .893 OPS, three homers and 13 driven in. Alexander Canario, a former South Bend Cub, he has been called up from AAA Iowa. Canario got his feet wet at the major league level last year in six games in September, hit .294, had a .941 on base percentage in just 17 at-bats. The problem for the Cubs lineup, Suzuki was hitting number two on the lineup, so they're going to have to switch things around to find another person to take over that very important spot in the Cubs lineup. So, Seiya Suzuki, oblique strain, and he is on the shelf. Again, had the same injury last spring training and was out 6 weeks. So, not good news for the Cubs. We're off to a good solid start at 9-6 and at Arizona tonight at 9:40. We'll talk some sports wagering. We'll bet on the Cubs and Diamondbacks coming up in just a moment on your home of the Fighting Irish, Sports Radio 960 WSBT.
Hey everyone, Saltgrass Steakhouse is now open in Mishawaka. Wrangle up the crew and head down to Saltgrass Mishawaka for an unforgettable experience. Sink your teeth into mouth-watering, char-grilled, certified Angus beef steaks. Sip on ice-cold craft cocktails. And don't forget to try the famous Spicy Range Rattlers, all made daily in the Scratch Kitchen. Start making delicious memories at Saltgrass Mishawaka, 5126 North Main Street, across from Lazy Boy Furniture Galleries. Dine with us today.